This is New England Public Radio's Jazz Beat. I'm Tom Reaney with a podcast edition of my jazz blog, which you can find at nepr.net. I'm speaking today with Lauren Schoenberg, a founding director and resident scholar at the National Jazz Museum in Harlem. And the primary purpose of our conversation today is the Savory Collection, an amazing treasure trove of material of the 30s and early 40s. Lauren, it is a pleasure to speak with you today. And, you know, right up front, just a hearty congratulations for all that you have done to bring this music to light and to distribution. And why don't you tell us a little bit about the Savory Collection and how you became aware of it?
Well, thanks, Tom. And it's a pleasure to speak with you. I've known of you and of your work for a long time, and it's nice to finally hear the voice and actually be in touch with you. I hope we can actually meet in person someday.
Thanks, Lauren.
And thank you for all you do. Yeah, I mean, I think the thing about the Savory Collection at its root is that it's a buried treasure story in general. I mean, the macro story would be it's a buried treasure. And, you know, it's one thing if you, like, let's say that we knew that there was a novel by, pick your favorite author, you know, let's say Mark Twain, and we knew that he wrote this book, and we couldn't find it, and we were looking for it, and we finally found it, and people would have already been spending a lot of time thinking about what it was about based on the title. This is as though, you found a new novel by Mark Twain that was unknown to exist, and not only was it good, but it was kind of the equal of Huckleberry Finn.
Right.
That's really kind of the story here. I mean, these recordings, I mean, Bill Savory recorded, you know, 1,000 discs, and he could have very easily recorded good to mediocre music. As it happens, he recorded excellent music. I found out about the collection in 1980. I had just gone to work for Benny Goodman, and I met this man, and his name was Bill Savory, and I knew that his broadcast recordings had been used for a series of 5 LPs that came out on 2 different labels in the 1950s. And they were broadcast recordings of Goodman and from the late 30s, and they were phenomenal. So my question was, how did you pick the best of everything that you had for those 2 albums? Because every track was a killer. And he said, I didn't pick the best of what I had. I just picked the best of what was in the first box. So I imagine, you know, Tom, that my reaction was just like yours would have been, like, well, my God, where are the other boxes? And that's what happened. So I spent 24 years, believe it or not, pestering this guy to let me hear it or look at it or see it. And eventually some lists circulated of some of the Goodman items that he had. And we just assumed that he had this wonderful treasure trove of Benny Goodman records. Well, after 30 years, I finally found someone who knew Bill Savory's son and went out to Malta, Illinois, a small little town out there, and met his son, who's a lovely chap, and in the living room were 50 boxes, and in the boxes, when we opened them, were not only Benny Goodman, but the things that you're hearing in Volume 1, you know, the Hamptons, the Hawkins, there's so many other things, and that's the story, and the rest, it really wouldn't have happened without the National Jazz Museum in Harlem in a certain way, because once I found it, our board chairman, Jonathan Scheuer, stepped in and immediately bought the collection for the museum from Bill Savory's son, which was wonderful. A, that Savory's son would consider letting it go, and B, that we were able to make it happen. And then the last 6 years were spent transferring all the material and getting it in good sound quality and also reaching agreements with the various people who we had to be able to issue it.
Mm-hmm.
That's a long answer.
Before we get back to Bill Savory, our listeners know what it was that you did for Benny Goodman and how that connection was established.
Sure. I was going to school. I was going to music school here in New York. And Benny Goodman was going to donate his library of arrangements at that time. He was deciding where to donate them to. And at first, he thought of the New York Public Library.
Mm-hmm.
And so he picked out about 300 of these later arrangements of his. And he asked the gentleman who had written what they call a biodiscography. I know it sounds more like a diagnosis than a book, but a biodiscography is a combination of a biography and a discography.
Who was that?
And Russ Conner.
Oh, okay.
And he asked him to write the accompanying history of these arrangements that he was going to donate, and Russ didn't have the time, so he recommended me. And because I was already a rabid Benny Goodman nut and a young musician, I knew some of the people who had worked with him and had kind of been around the periphery of his world. I mean, the periphery of the periphery. And he called and asked if I would be willing to come up and work for him, kind of on a on this project basis, to give these arrangements, which means that I would have to interview him about them. And I did, and it was really great. And then through a long series of events, his personal manager of 40 years had quit. They needed someone to come in and answer the phones. And by the time I turned 21, I was his personal, or 22, I was his personal manager. And that eventually led, 2 years or 3 years later, to his hiring my big band, and we became the last Benny Goodman Orchestra. So that's the short version of it.
I interviewed Ross Firestone years ago when he published his biography of Goodman. We devoted a show to that back in what would have been the mid-90s or so.
It was a while ago, but that's a great book. Ross is a wonderful author.
And just last week with Phil Wood's election to the Downbeat Hall of Fame, we were doing a feature on Phil, and I was digging into his memoir about the tour of Russia with Goodman in 1962, I think it was, and he quotes Zoot Sims, you know, when asked, how was it working with Benny? And Zoot says something like, every day with Benny is like a tour of Russia with Benny. I wonder how you found Benny Goodman to work with.
Well, I'll tell you. Benny and Zoot really did love each other. And Zoot was almost like a son to Benny because he had first played in Benny's band when he was still a teenager, I believe, in 1943. And Benny was a mercurial guy and an incredible, well, we all know about his talent. And he helped a lot of people. Once you played with him or were associated with him, it really helped establish your career. And I really think of him now, I think of the personal things kind of like as petty and not worth really dwelling on.
Sure.
And I've long wondered why people have always focused on the, you know, on the more petty parts. I mean, we all have petty parts, and he had them too. But he was an incredible artist. At times, a great guy to be with. Helped him, did a lot of things in terms of philanthropy with musicians that he never wanted to be known. And so I'm kind of on the other side of the spectrum of the famous Benny Goodman story. Can't deny them, but there was another side to the guy too.
Nice, yeah. In your liner note essay for the Savory Collection, you say that Bill Savory is worthy of a biography unto himself. Tell us a little bit more about Bill Savory.
Well, I would be happy to if I knew more. I can tell you why I said that.
Okay.
I know that he was a genius of, I'm not even sure what, Tom, what the right word would be. It's not mechanics. Electric mechanics, technology, and it manifested itself in many, many different ways. I know that he did do work for the government. I know that he did do work for intelligence agencies. I know that George Avakian, who worked with him famously at Columbia Records for many years, said that, you know, Bill would just disappear for weeks or months at a time, and no one ever asked where he was, and he never said where he was. He just came back and picked up his job again. And he did live in Falls Church, Virginia, when I knew him, which, of course, is where all the quote-unquote spooks were, live.
Right.
And so his son, Gene, is very much with us. He's in Malta, and he would be the first one to talk to try and figure out. I mean, he's just told little, shed, opened little doors into the story that, you know, his father was flying planes in Vietnam and he was, you know, doing all kinds of odd things. So, yeah, he's a fascinating guy. He may have even had more than one family. I don't know, but he was a mystery man.
We're going to listen to Coleman Hawkins performing Body and Soul in a moment. But before we get to Hawk and that wonderful discovery, I was listening to the samples that are on the website at the National Jazz Museum in Harlem. And they include, you know, phenomenal Lester Young with Count Basie. But I also heard Louis Armstrong playing on the Sunny Side of the Street. It sounds almost as though Fats Waller is the pianist. Tell me a little bit more about the Armstrong, and is that going to be released eventually?
The Louis Armstrong tracks, and I'll tell you about what exists in the Savory Collection. There are a few titles with his own big band, with Big Sid Catlett on drums from 1939, one of which has him doing kind of like a talking trumpet thing that I believe there are no other recordings of, so that's kind of interesting. But the session you're referring to was one of the Martin Block jam sessions, and there are about six or seven of them, and you're absolutely right. The one you heard the sample of is with Fats Waller and Jack Teagarden and Bud Freeman.
Oh, wow.
And it has been bootlegged over the years. It came out on 78, and it's been bootlegged in mediocre sound quality. Our version of it, is, like you hear on that short sample, is in phenomenal sound quality, and we're currently trying to get permission from the requisite estates to be able to issue that session. I hope that we can.
Right. Yeah, that sound is outstanding. A water performance, so I certainly hope that that becomes available.
For you and me. Boy,
sure.
I do, too.
So,
and I should mention, I'm sorry, Tom, just to interject that, you know, for folks who want to hear everything in the Savory Collection, and I mean everything, you can. If you come to visit us in Harlem, we're at 58 West 129th Street, right off of Lenox Avenue, and near all the great restaurants, and Harlem has really undergone a tremendous change, and it's just full of wonderful people who live there and tourists and restaurants and places to go. And if you want to come visit us, you make an appointment and you can listen to your heart's desire for days to everything in the Savory Collection, including the things that for a bunch of reasons probably will never be issued because we just can't get the right permissions. So the stuff is accessible if you happen to come to Harlem.
All right. That's good to know. The first collection of Savory material, that which is commercially available through iTunes, leads off, no surprise, with this phenomenal performance of Body and Soul by Coleman Hawkins. Let's listen to that first and then talk about its significance after we hear this performance of Coleman Hawkins and Body and Soul. That was Body and Soul, a magnificent performance by Coleman Hawkins of the ballad that he had famously recorded in 1939. Tell us about this performance of Body and Soul, where it's from, and its great significance.
Well, that was recorded at a place called the Fiesta Danceteria early in 1940. It was a very strange place. It was called the world's first self-service nightclub, and I think what that meant, after doing some research, is that they had kind of an automat, a place where you could eat on the same floor, so you could get your own food and then go dance to the bands. Coleman Hawkins was in the midst of a big dispute with the owner of the place, who was lamenting the fact that, you know, Hawkins was playing these long songs, everybody was playing solos, and there wasn't enough variety, and the people weren't, you know, changing partners and dancing enough. And I believe he got fired after a week or two. So it's kind of ironic that the one track we have is indeed Hawkins playing a ballad for 6 minutes and stretching out. I guess its historic significance is that, you know, months earlier he had made this recording for Bluebird Records. He had just come back from Europe. He was an ancient guy, jazz terms. I believe he was 35 years old. And so, you know, everyone thought, man, Lester Young and Ben Webster and these other great saxophone players had really kind of taken his place. And
yeah, the 30-year-olds.
Yes, yes. And, you know, they were wondering if, you know, Hawk had kind of lost it. And so he goes to make a record, and he records three good songs, and then, boom, the fourth one is Body and Soul, which he kind of disingenuously refers to, oh, you know, just the last tune, and I didn't know what to do, and so... What the hell, they asked me to play it, and I played it. But it turns out that Body and Soul had indeed been his encore piece throughout his European years.
Right.
And so he'd obviously honed it into something. So this record came out in late 39 and immediately became a classic amongst musicians and among some of the listening public. I mean, it was like a Bach variation, you know, and boom, it came out and people loved it. And so the thought that we would have kind of a second draft, or actually, in a way, a version that, I mean, I think it's as good or better than the famous one, is kind of shocking. And then add to that that it's in superb fidelity.
You know, one of the remarkable things about the Savory Collection performance of Body and Soul is that Hawk is sort of doubling the length of his solo, if you will. It's I think it's four choruses long that we just heard.
Twice as long.
Right, right. Well,
it's kind of amazing, you know. It's kind of amazing, you know, that he doubles the chorus length. I mean, the original is, you know, two choruses. This is four choruses.
Right.
And he builds and builds and builds. You know, I heard from Lou Tabakin, a wonderful saxophone player, and there's a thing that Hawk does on the last bridge where he goes, blip, 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 like that. Kind of like sheets of sound. And Lou Tabakin said, yeah, man, he goes, Coltrane.
Sure, yeah. Well, we know that John was a heavy listener to Coleman Hawkins. And
he recorded with Coleman Hawkins.
Right, with Thelonious Monk, yeah. Let's jump ahead to Ella Fitzgerald. Ella's centennial is in April, and it's timely to have some new discoveries on Ella. And her performance here of A Tisk at a Task, it just really knocks me out. Let's give a listen to that and talk about Ella in just a moment.
A task, a brown and yellow basket. I send a letter to my mommy. On the way I dropped it, I dropped it, I dropped it. Yes, on the way I dropped it. A little girlie picked it up and put it in her pocket. She was trucking on down the avenue with not a single thing to do. She went a peck a peck a pecking all around. When she spied it on the ground, she took it, she took it, my little yellow basket. And if she doesn't bring it back, I think that I will die.
Lauren, that performance of A Tisk at a Task by Ella Fitzgerald, she sounds mature beyond her years. What year was that performed, and is she with Chick Webb in that session?
Oh, yeah. In fact, that's Chick Webb on drums. And what happened was Ella and Chick, and this is done in late 1938, were guesting on something called the CBS Saturday Night Swing Club. And they had a very good house band, led by Leith Stevens, and they would have guests come in. And so, you know, this record of Chick's, you know, just a task, it was the biggest thing. So they bought the chart, and the band read it, but you get to hear Chick, and it's kind of funny. He stays in the background for the most part, but there are a handful of drum cracks. I think of it almost like those old Westerns when somebody would shoot and say to somebody, you know, dance, you know. And I think that's kind of what he's doing to the band. And Ella I mean, she's fully formed. That's the Ella Fitzgerald that we know and love. And as you remark, yeah, she's hard to believe how young she is. She's in her early 20s.
Right. I'm impressed with the amount of Lionel Hampton material that's included in this first volume from the Savory Collection. And as you note, Herschel Evans is here on tenor saxophone and what you call his swan song. And there's a beautiful take on Stardust. I thought for this conversation, we'd hear Rosetta, which not only has a nice solo by Herschel, but the wonderful young Charlie Shavers on trumpet. So here's Lionel Hampton at the vibraphone with his all-star ad hoc group, which we'll talk about in a minute, performing Earl Hines' great song, Rosetta. That's Lionel Hampton leading an all-star ad hoc group in a performance of Rosetta, Earl Hines' great song. And that's one of the highlights from the Savory Collection, the first volume from this collection, which has been released by the National Jazz Museum in Harlem. And I'm Tom Reaney, speaking with Lauren Schoenberg, founding director and resident scholar of the National Jazz Museum in Harlem. And Lauren, what a terrific performance of Rosetta there with Herschel Evans and Charlie Shavers.
I'll tell you, man, it's astonishing. I mean, first of all, that it's an extended performance. Second of all, that it's in superb fidelity. And just to hear them jamming like that, I mean, that's what they really sounded like in person. You know, what we hear on the studio recording is hearing our favorite musicians under a lot of pressure. And here they're not under any pressure.
You described this performance as Herschel Evans' swan song. The tenor saxophonist was with Count Basie's band at that point. He died in, what was it, 1939?
Very early in 1939, yeah. Just several weeks later almost.
And area listeners here in western New England will be interested to know that I think Herschel's last performance with Count Basie was at the Estate Theater in Hartford, but here he is with Lionel Hampton. And do you know how this group came together? Was this related to the Benny Goodman concert at Carnegie Hall?
I think this came together because the Goodman band was in town. The Carnegie Hall concert was in January, and then they were tremendously busy that year. And by this time, later in the year, they were, I think, at the Waldorf Astoria. And in fact, Lionel Hampton was at that time also playing a lot of drums with Benny Goodman's band, because Goodman was in between drummers, as he frequently was. And, you know, Hamp had been recording a series of all-star jam sessions, as you know, Tom, played the records for Victor Records. And so, you know, he would look around town and see who was around. So clearly, the Cab Calloway band was in town. In fact, Cab Calloway was very famous. Milt Hinton writes about it in his books for giving his band the Christmas holidays off on a paid vacation. That was extraordinarily unusual for band leaders back in those days. So, you know, he got Milt Hinton, and he got Cozy Cole on the drum. From Tommy Dorsey's band, Howard Smith was on piano. and the Basie Band was there. So we got Herschel Evans. Charlie Shavers was with John Kirby. And also with the Goodman Band were the alto player Dave Matthews and Vernon Brown on trombone. So I guess Hampus called these cats and said, why don't you come up and play on this Martin Block jam session on WNEW? And they jammed. And it's just amazing, I mean, as you referred to it, how cohesive it is. I mean, these were guys who did not play together. They were playing 7 days a week in other bands with other arrangements. And, you know, I'm sure they had in their head hundreds of pieces of music that they were playing day after day after day. And they probably loved the opportunity just to let it all fly.
Mm-hmm. Another tune that really knocks me out in the collection is Carl Kress, the guitarist, and a performance of a Heat Wave, Irving Berlin's song. And what really jumped out at me was the chordal work on this. I thought, this sounds like a prototype for rock and roll. And before we hear it, Lauren, do you know which year this was recorded and what the venue was?
It was recorded in 1936 as part of a kind of an early history of swing broadcast that was done. And they had Benny Goodman's band and Mildred Bailey. Not sure that they had any African-American artists. Not sure. But they had Carl Kress and Dick McDonough, who had been recording a series of guitar duets. And it's just kind of like the apogee, almost, of acoustic guitar playing. In other words, Charlie Christian came in with Benny Goodman a few years later, and the electric guitar kind of obliterated everything else. And that beautiful dulcet acoustic style of strumming solos kind of went out the window for most people. And this is just incredible. They had recorded it commercially. Well, I think they recorded it about a year later. And when you compare the two versions, you'll see that they're similar, but certain passages are different. The reason that we put it on the album, along with the Emilio Caceres trio track, was to highlight that the Savory Collection contains not only the big blockbuster names, but many people who are unknown or almost unknown. And we're going to pepper all of the albums, save the next one. The next album is all Basie and Lester Young. Right. But the rest of the volumes will be back in this format of mixing and matching things. And we'll always be throwing in some of the obscurities because people should hear it.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a nice motivation there. Good mission work. And let's hear the magnificent playing now of Carl Kress on Heat Wave. Was Carl Kress performing Heat Wave, and that's from the first volume of the Savory Collection, just out from the National Jazz Museum in Harlem and available through iTunes. And again, Lauren, that impressed me. The chordal work on that sounded like a prototype for rock and roll. You mentioned that the next volume in the Savory Collection will be devoted to Basie and Lester Young, and I'm curious to hear it, to hear more about it, but you know, for the moment, let's just take a... I want to acknowledge you as the author of just a brilliant essay collection that comes with the recent Mosaic Records collection of Lester Young and Count Basie and Lester's work between 1936 and 47. And, Lauren, it's so valuable to have this work in one collection now. And I think, you know, as much as we glorify Lester Young, and he remains one of the most hallowed names among jazz aficionados, he's, you know, I noticed in like Jazz Times magazine a few years ago, they did a survey of players on or on journalists on like their top five records by tenor saxophone players. And Lester Young really gets short shrift in this survey. And it's not so much that the contributors don't appreciate Lester Young, but more that Lester was one of the most important and influential figures in the music for at least 7 years on records before his name ever appeared on record. And I'm thinking this, and I, you know, I thought that had a lot to do with why he's so infrequently mentioned in this Jazz Times survey relative to other tenor players who were, you know, making lots of sides, whether they were 78s or later on albums under their own names. And moreover, of course, that so much of Lester's important work was done as a sideman, whether it was with Basie or Teddy Wilson, Billie Holiday, the Kansas City Seven, and groups like that, that it wasn't until 1943, I think, that we actually see his name on one of those keynote sessions that he led. And so I was really delighted to see this Mosaic collection come out last year, which brings together Lester's extensive work during that entire period with Basie and with his own groups in the 40s. And again, kudos to you for a great read in your essay.
Well, thanks. And I should mention that, you know, when people purchase the Savory Volume 1 on iTunes, it does come with, you know, an extensive digital liner note that I wrote some of, and I got some great folks to talk about. So it comes with a beautifully designed color liner note with pictures and all the discographical information and all the stuff spelled out. So that's also part of this album. It's very important that we insisted that happen. And I think we've kind of created a new level of the digital liner note.
Yeah, it's very impressive. And of course, you have entries here from Dan Morgenstern, James Carter, and others. And yeah, it's a good read, just like the Mosaic collection. But so tell me about Lester and Count Basie in this next collection that you're planning from the Savory collection.
One of the high watermarks of American music, I mean, is the Count Basie band of the late 1930s. And, you know, Tom, you mentioned it in passing, and I want to underline it because I couldn't agree more. To begin with, there were so many other great players in that band. I was fortunate enough to actually get to know them and actually make music with a lot of them. And it was always a little uncomfortable because the interviews that we did or many that everyone did with them would invariably get to Lefty Young and would want to know everything about him and what he did. And you know, Buddy Tate and Buck Clayton and Dickie Wells and Sweet Edison and Earl Warren and all these other musicians, I mean, they were so wonderful. And they have been given short shrift in comparison to Lester Young. But this is what happens. I mean, you know, there are other playwrights at the time of Shakespeare and other inventors at the time of Edison, on and on, you know, and other singers at the time of Billie Holiday and Ella Fitzgerald. I mean, whoever talks about Mildred Bailey?
All right. Well, Lee Wiley.
Right. So, you know, there's a lot of folks who are deserving of recognition, but, you know, you just have to confront the fact that Lester Young, you know, not only changed the way that the saxophone was played, but it changed the way that jazz was played and the way that jazz was listened to and the way that jazz was thought. And very, very few people have ever done anything. I mean, it's almost impossible to think about Miles Davis without Lester Young. And think about, you know, what came out of Miles Davis and Charlie Parker. Mm-hmm. There'd be no Charlie Parker without Lester Young. So, you know, he is that kind of rare, rare figure. And his early recordings made before he went into the Army in 1944 are, you know, they're unique. And Sonny Rollins once said of him, he said, you know, and he knew Lester Young and had sat in with him. He said, you know, I just think, you know, Lester Young was from another planet. And it sounds like kind of a glib comment, but there's something actually to it, that he was so unique and his conception was so complete that you wonder how someone could have come up with it and been brave enough in the face of the kind of rejection that he faced going into his late 20s,
right,
to play the way that he played. I mean, he was fired or had to quit, you know, the number one gig of a saxophone player in the black jazz dance world of the 1930s. I mean, he was in the Fletcher Henderson band taking Coleman Hawkins' place, and he was made to feel so uncomfortable that he left. Mm-hmm. Now, most people would have just, you know, crawled up in the hole, and that would have been it, you know. But right. He waited, and he stuck to his guns, and Count Basie put him front and forward, and 2 or 3 years later, he came back and conquered the world. Mm-hmm. Kind of an amazing story. So working on these sets, there are two mosaic box sets of Lester Young with Count Basie, and, you know, it's just so great to have that material in good sound quality and available to buy. And so volume two of the Savory Collection, unlike the bulk of the material on the mosaic box sets, has never been heard before. Mm-hmm. Not one of them. They're all new. And it's over an hour's worth of material. From 1938 through 1940, the sound quality is superb. And you can hear little things in the band. When you listen carefully, you'll hear things from the drums, the guitar, and the trumpets that you've never been able to hear before. Mm-hmm. And it's really phenomenal. Of all the things in the collection, these are some of my favorites.
Is that Jumping at the Woodside that you have a sample of on the website?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, man, that is so great. Wow.
Yeah. And there are also songs that the band never recorded, arrangements that they never recorded, and versions of songs that they did record that had to be cut short when they made the commercial record. And now we can hear how they really played the Texas Shuffle, mm-hmm. or mm-hmm. what Blue and Sentimental sounded like in person. It's very different from the record. So, you know, and there's also a lot of Lester Young on the clarinet, more than I would have ever thought.
Right.
So there's mm-hmm. a lot mm-hmm. to listen for there.
Herschel Evans, the legendary tenor player of Count Basie's band, there with Lionel Hampton's jam session. You've spent a lot of time with recordings made, you know, on location, as it were, starting with Benny Goodman's work and Bill Savory's collection of BG, and now all of this work with the Savory Collection. And you're already addressing it a bit in your remarks, but I just wonder if you're arriving at a different sort of take on jazz history vis-a-vis how much emphasis is placed on studio recordings versus what you're discovering as you listen more and more to actual broadcast and, you know, concert, dance hall, danceteria performances.
The great bulk of people who've written about jazz and love jazz, you know, have kind of focused on the studio recordings, on the things that came out on records. And that's natural because for so long, that's all that there was. It was pretty much just the diehard jazz fans like you and me, you know, who would, you know, dig in for the rare records and the tapes and those kind of things. And in the last few decades, you know, more and more and more has come to light of how these people actually played on the gig, at night, in the club, on the bandstand. And yes, I think I agree with you. I mean, I think there are new judgments to be made and new thoughts to be had and more joy to be had in listening to this music based on all this stuff. For instance, Gunther Schuller's epic work, The Swing Era, mm-hmm. Which is, you know, one of the Bibles that you would go to, you know, give a serious listen and thought to this stuff. Gunther was actually urged to integrate the live recordings into his analyses, and he didn't. And So that just leaves the door open for the next Gunther Schiller, I guess, or the next whomever, to come along and redo it. So I agree with you wholeheartedly. These recordings add a lot of new information.
Yeah, you know, my earlier observations of, you know, the air check phenomenon had me, you know, persuaded early on that the three-minute idiom that the 78 RPM kind of enforced on jazz was maintained in live performance settings as well. And yet over time, I think I've begun to understand that those three-minute takes that we hear from the Southland Ballroom or from the Meadowbrook or from the Savoy or wherever, they were all radio broadcasts. So they were sort of confined in that way as well to pretty much mirror what was on records. But now that we get into the Savory and other sources of actual performance material that was not broadcast or strictly broadcast related, you hear these more expansive takes on tunes, and it's really an amazing revelation. I mean, the Coleman Hawkins four choruses on Body and Soul alone is such an amazing discovery here from 1940, and you've got a 9.5 minute long blues by Lionel Hampton in this first volume.
I must mention that these were all broadcast, you know, but that that there are broadcasts and there are broadcasts.
Right. Okay. Huh. Well, some of these are really quite unusual length. I mean, you've got 7 and 9, almost 10 minutes on Hamp, a couple of 6 minute by Hawk, 5.5 minute medley by Fats Waller. Fascinating. You know, you mentioned too that working with Basieites, Buddy Tate, and Buck Layton and others, and how invariably, you know, everybody wants to know about Prez. It's kind of like Johnny Shines, the great blues man. I mean, any encounter anyone ever had with Johnny Shines, it was like, tell me about Robert Johnson, you know, that kind of thing. and how, you know, much the critical perspective is influenced by a phenomenon like that. But I was doing a sort of a blog feature on Buddy Tate 2 or 3 years ago, and there I found Buddy talking about, I think it was the 20-plus years that he spent playing at the Celebrity Club in Harlem. Mm-hmm. And that was like the late 50s through the 70s. And he said that during that whole time, no critic came uptown to do a feature on the great music and the very popular in-demand music that Buddy Tate was playing during that 2-plus decade period.
Tom, you know, I'd like to give you a little insight into Buddy Tate. It's a story that kind of almost seems self-serving, but I'm going to tell it anyway because it just shows you about the guy. When I was in my late teens and early 20s, I was playing in New York at a place called the West End up by Columbia University, where Phil Schaff was booking musicians from all the great bands, and they had almost to a man been forgotten and were not working. Some actually had day jobs working as messengers or bank guards or were just struggling by, and they were, you know, giants. And thank God Phil gave them work and they got to play. And even more, I mean, and part and parcel of that was the fact that, you know, they're just the feeling of getting up and getting dressed and going to play in a club once a week or 3 or 4 nights a week meant so much. And we got to hear so much great music. Well, I was lucky enough to substitute there because I lived around the corner and eventually play there quite a bit. And I got to know Buddy Tate. And do you know what he did? And it's in my scrapbook, and I will never forget it to the day I die. You know, I would go sit in, and my parents would come, you know, here's the little kid playing in the club, with a couple jazz musicians kind of far out for them. And Buddy was such a gentleman and such a great, so avuncular, that first of all, he made my parents feel comfortable that their little boy was now, you know, playing with jazz musicians. And, you know, well, gosh, if they're like Buddy Tate and Eddie Durham, man, well, it's much better that he's doing that than something else. And he sent me a Christmas card, which I have in my scrapbook, and it just says, you know, you sure sounded good the other night. You know, God bless you and your family from Buddy, and I forget his wife's name. And he just sent this card. And I think that really kind of speaks volumes to how most of these men were with young players, you know, supportive. They were mentors. And wonderful, wonderful people. And that's an element that sometimes just doesn't get stressed enough when we're, you know, talking about history and innovation and, you know, who played with whom and what chord did they play and all this kind of stuff. And it's, thank God, you know, I mean, you mentioned Buddy Payne. I'm happy to chime in with that anecdote.
Sure, thank you. Great story. And, you know, I'm also recalling the beautiful way that Buddy told the story of riding back from Newport with Lester Young there around 58 or so, and just how much humanity is revealed in that story as Buddy, as Lady Tate, as Prez called him, relates about
yes.
Lester. In our last few minutes here, I wanted to also highlight the fact that the National Jazz Museum in Harlem has a Ralph Ellison collection, and, you know, when I was a college student, and even well before I got to college, I was an Ellison reader of every word I could find on Ralph. And later on, when I began working here out of Amherst, Massachusetts, I was delighted within weeks of the inception of this show back in 1984 to begin getting some notes from Ralph Ellison, who had a summer home or a second home up here in Western New England, and that's still kind of like the capstone of my career as having Ralph Ellison as a listener. But tell us about Ralph Ellison vis-a-vis the National Jazz Museum in Harlem.
Well, first of all, I just have to kind of just get back from reeling here, just hearing about the fact that Ralph Ellison listened to your show, and not only that, but let you know it.
Gosh. and let me add, Lauren, to complete the story, with financial contributions, too.
Oh, man. I tell you, Tom, I mean, Ralph Ellison was a tough cookie, man, and he didn't, I never knew him. I knew Albert Murray and Stanley Kraft and people who knew him, but I it's fair to say he was a tough cookie, and he didn't suffer fools gladly and didn't want to listen to his the music he loved so much unless it was presented the right way. And yeah, man, I mean, that's I'm thrilled to hear that. And you must treasure my
Absolutely.
God, Ralph Ellison. Well, Ralph Ellison had a recording, as anyone knows, you know, he listened incessantly and listened when he wrote sometimes and lived and breathed the music. And after he passed away and after his wife Fanny passed away, they were deciding what to do with the things that had not been bequeathed. In other words, I believe most of his stuff is at Yale University, I think, maybe in the Beinecke Library or somewhere up there.
Mm-hmm.
And among the things that no one had really thought about were the recordings, the actual LPs and 78s and stuff, you know, that were in his collection that he actually listened to while he wrote these great things. So we had the opportunity to get them. We created exhibit couple of years ago that was graphically centered on using the records and the record labels and the things associated with the records to kind of create the world of Ralph Ellison. So we did. And it's currently being shown at the New Jersey Performing Arts Center in Newark, where they had a concert with Wynton Marsalis and Christian McBride and people called Jazz McGee of Ellison. So that exhibit is still exists. And people, scholars, will come visit, and I believe we still have a website up. There's a link to it on our website of rare things from the Ellison collection. We also discovered a broadcast from 1965, I think it is, that was on WNEP with Martin Williams and Ralph Ellison introducing Cecil Taylor and Charles Mingus.
Right.
And was written up in the New Yorker magazine.
Right, yeah. As long as we've mentioned Ralph Ellison, I just want to make kind of a final mention here of an event that you're hosting on Saturday. Now, by the time we're all listening to this, this event will have already passed, but I wonder perhaps if it's going to be archived in some way, but the Stanley Crouch Symposium that you're hosting on Saturday, and Crouch, the journalist and jazz scholar who was mentored or protege of Ralph Ellison and Albert Murray.
The event is called The Life and Times of Stanley Crouch. And it is celebrating the decades of influence that Stanley Crouch has had on American letters and on jazz and all different kinds of thinking. And he was mentored very much by Ralph Ellison. He wrote a wonderful piece in the New Republic called The Oklahoma Kid, and I'm sure that's in one of his anthologies, and he really puts into perspective Ellison, and Ellison, of course, who put into perspective so much about America and the way that we think about things. So we're having an event And we have Wynton Marsalis, Robert O'Mealy, Gary Giddens, Dan Morgenstern, Paul Devlin, among others, all there to talk about their lifelong friendship and respect for Stanley Crouch. And the common denominator for everyone is also Ralph Ellison, because while some of us didn't know Ralph, we knew Albert Murray and Stanley. And this event is being recorded. It's being professionally videotaped and also audio recording, and we will make it available on the museum website at some point.
Oh, that's great. Well, I'll look forward to that, and we can confirm that when it becomes available. So, again, I've been speaking with Lauren Schoenberg today, a founding director and resident scholar at the National Jazz Museum in Harlem, and about the Savory Collection, the first volume of which is available for download through iTunes, and it contains some of the recordings that we've heard in this edition of Jazz Beat, and additional material with Fats Waller, with Emilio Caceres, with there's more of Ella Fitzgerald, Coleman Hawkins, and the Lionel Hampton Jam Session as well. So thanks very much for being with us today, Lauren, and we'll talk again when the Lester Young Count Basie collection comes out, and why not wrap it up by telling us if you have a projected release date for that?
The Count Basie featuring Lester Young album will be coming out in early December, probably by the end of the second week, I believe.
Oh.
So stay tuned for news about that. I look forward to talking with you again about it, Tom, and I just want to say, you know, there's a handful of bright lights out there, you know, who for decades have been keeping the flame, and I love what you do, and it's an honor to finally talk with you on the air.
Well, thank you very much, Lauren, and feeling is mutual, and I look forward to seeing you in person one of these days in the city.
Absolutely.
All right.
See you soon.
For additional music samples and information about the Savory Collection, visit the website of the National Jazz Museum in Harlem at jmih.org and the Jazz Blog at nepr.net. Thanks to Katie Wright for production assistance. For Jazz Beat, I'm Tom Reaney. Here's Fats Waller with another highlight from the Savory Collection.
Ladies and gentlemen, ahoy there, mates. We're at the Yacht Club.
Hello.
Yeah, hello is up. That's Fats Waller sitting here at the piano saying hello over my shoulder. The Yacht Club on 52nd Street, the gay nightway of New York City, and swinging right around with a little Yacht Club swing in the best Fats Waller manner. Here's Fats himself to talk it as well as play it.
Yeah, please, boys. Latch on and hold my hand. Yes, yes. Are you gonna hold it? Come on, baby, hold my hand. Hold it, hold it, hold it, yeah.